beginning of your journey. Chapter 6. The Father's Voice. No man, for any considerable period of time, can wear one face to himself and another to the multitude without finally getting bewildered as to which may be the truth. Nathaniel Hawthorne. Esse quam videri. To be rather than to appear. Who can give a man this, his own name? George MacDonald. Summers in the eastern Oregon sagebrush are hot, dry, and dusty. When the sun was high, the temperature could soar into the 90s, so whenever possible, we saved most of the hard labor on the ranch for the early morning or late afternoon and evening, when the cool air drifted up from the river valley below. Sometimes we'd fix irrigation ditches during the heat of the day, which for me was a great excuse to get really wet. I'd tromp along in the ditch, letting the warm, muddy water soak my jeans. But most of the time, we'd head back to the ranch house for a glass of iced tea. Pop loved his tea sweetened with a healthy dose of sugar, the way they drink it in the South. We'd sit at the kitchen table and have a glass or two and talk about the events of the morning or a plan he had to sell some cattle at the auction or how he thought we'd spend the afternoon. One day late in the summer of my 13th year, Pop and I had just come in for our ritual when he stood up and walked over to the window. The kitchen faced south and from there gave a view over a large alfalfa field and then on toward the pasture land. Like most ranchers, Pop grew his own hay to provide feed for cattle and horses he kept over the winter. I joined him at the window and saw that a steer had gotten out of the range and into the alfalfa. I remember my grandfather telling me that it's dangerous for a cow to stuff itself on fresh alfalfa. It expands in their stomach like rising bread and could rupture one of their four chambers. Pop was clearly irritated, as only a cowboy can be irritated at cattle. I, on the other hand, was excited. This meant adventure. "Go saddle up Tony and get that steer," he said, sitting back in his chair and kicking his boots up on the one in front of him. His demeanor made it clear that he was not going with me. He was, in fact, not going anywhere. As he poured himself another glass of tea, my mind raced through the implications of what he'd said. It meant I first had to go catch Tony, the biggest horse on the ranch. I was scared of Tony, but we both knew he was the best cattle horse. I had to saddle him up by myself and ride out to get that steer. Alone. Having processed this information, I realized I had been standing there for who knows how long, and it was time I got going. As I walked out the back porch toward the corral, I felt two things and felt them strongly. Fear and honor. Most of our life-changing moments are realized as such later. I couldn't have told you why, but I knew I'd crossed a threshold in my life as a young man. Pop believed in me, and whatever he saw that I did not, the fact that he believed made me believe it too. I got the steer that day, and a whole lot more. A man needs to know his name. He needs to know he's got what it takes. And I don't mean no in the modernistic, rationalistic sense. I don't mean that the thought has passed through your cerebral cortex and you've given it intellectual assent, the way you know about the Battle of Waterloo or the ozone layer, the way most men know God or the truths of Christianity. I mean a deep knowing, the kind of knowing that comes when you have been there, entered in, experienced firsthand in an unforgettable way, the way Adam knew his wife and she gave birth to a child. Adam didn't know about Eve. He knew her intimately, through flesh and blood experience at a very deep level. There's knowledge about and knowledge of. When it comes to our question, we need the latter. In the movie Gladiator, set in the 2nd century AD, the hero is a warrior from Spain called Maximus. He is the commander of the Roman armies, a general loved by his men and by the aging emperor Marcus Aurelius. The emperor's foul son, Commodus, learns of his father's plan to make Maximus emperor in his place. But before Marcus can pronounce his successor, Commodus strangles his father. He sentences Maximus to immediate execution and his wife and son to crucifixion and burning. Maximus escapes, but too late to save his family. Captured by slave traders, he is sold as a gladiator. That fate is normally a death sentence. But this is Maximus, a valiant fighter. He more than survives, he becomes a champion. Ultimately, he is taken to Rome to perform in the Colosseum before the Emperor Commodus, who of course believes that Maximus is long dead. After a remarkable display of courage and a stunning upset, the emperor comes down into the arena to meet the valiant gladiator, whose identity remains hidden behind his helmet. Commodus: "Your fame is well deserved, Spaniard. I don't believe there's ever been a gladiator that matched you. Why doesn't the hero reveal himself and tell us all your real name?" Maximus is silent. "You do have a name." "My name is Gladiator." He turns and walks away. "How dare you show your back to me, slave? You will remove your helmet and tell me your name." Slowly, very slowly, lifts his helmet and turns to face his enemy. "My name is Maximus Decimus Meridius, commander of the armies of the north, general of the Felix legions, loyal servant to the true emperor, Marcus Aurelius, father to a murdered son, husband to a murdered wife, and I will have my vengeance in this life or in the next." His answer builds like a mighty wave, swelling in size and strength before it crashes on the shore. Where does a man go to learn an answer like that? To learn his true name, a name that can never be taken from him. That deep heart knowledge comes only through a process of initiation. You have to know where you've come from. You have to have faced a series of trials that test you. You have to have taken a journey, and you have to have faced your enemy. But as a young man recently lamented to me, "I've been a Christian since I was 5. No one ever showed me what it means to really be a man." He's lost now. He moved across the country to be with his girlfriend, but she's dumped him because he doesn't know who he is and what he's here for. There are countless others like him, a world of such men, a world of uninitiated men. The church would like to think it is initiating men, but it's not. What does the church bring a man into? What does it call him out to be? Moral. That is pitifully insufficient. Morality is a good thing, but morality is never the point. Paul says the law is given as a tutor to the child, but not to the son. The son is invited up into something much more. He gets the keys to the car. He gets to go away with the father on some dangerous mission. I'm struck by the poignancy of the scene at the end of the Civil War, just after Appomattox, where General Robert E. Lee has surrendered to General Ulysses S. Grant. For 5 years, Lee has led the Army of Northern Virginia through some of the most terrible trials men have ever known. You would think they'd be glad to have it over. But Lee's men hang upon the reins of his horse and beg him not to go, plead for one more chance to whip those Yankees. Lee had become their father, had given those men what most of them had never had before, an identity and a place in a larger story. Every man needs to know someone like Robert E. Lee, or that Brigadier General from the 29th. "You've seen how to take a house? Do you understand? Do you know how to do it now?" "Yes, sir." We need someone like my grandfather, who can teach us how to saddle up. But Lee is long gone. Brigadier generals are rare. My grandfather has been dead for many years. Where do we go? To whom can we turn? To a most surprising source. A number of years ago, at a point in my own journey when I felt more lost than ever, I heard a talk given by Gordon Dalby, who had just written Healing the Masculine Soul. He raised the idea that despite a man's past and the failures of his own father to initiate him, God could take him on that journey, provide what was missing. A hope rose within me, but I dismissed it with the cynicism I'd learned to use to keep down most things in my soul. Several weeks, perhaps months later, I was downstairs in the early morning to read and pray. As with so many of my quiet times, I ended up looking out the window toward the east to watch the sunrise. I heard Jesus whisper a question to me. "Will you let me initiate you?" Before my mind ever had a chance to process, dissect, and doubt the whole exchange, my heart leaped up and said yes. "Who can give a man this, his own name?" George MacDonald asks. "God alone, for no one but God sees what the man is." He reflects upon the white stone that Revelation includes among the rewards God will give to those who overcome. On that white stone, there is a new name. It is new only in the sense that it is not the name the world gave to us, certainly not the one delivered with the wound. No man will find on that stone Mama's Boy or Fatty or Seagull. But the new name is really not new at all. When you understand that it is your true name, the one that belongs to you, that being whom he had in his thought when he began to make the child, and whom he kept in his thought throughout the long process of creation and redemption. Psalm 139 makes it clear that we were personally, uniquely planned and created, knit together in our mother's womb by God himself. He had someone in mind, and that someone has a name. That someone has also undergone a terrible assault, and yet God remains committed to the realization of that same someone. The giving of the white stone makes it clear that is what he is up to. The history of a man's relationship with God is the story of how God calls him out, takes him on a journey, and gives him his true name. Most of us have thought it was the story of how God sits on his throne, waiting to whack a man broadside when he steps out of line. Not so. He created Adam for adventure, battle, and beauty. He created us for a unique place in his story and is committed to bringing us back to the original design. So God calls Abram out of Ur of the Chaldees to a land he has never seen, to the frontier. And along the way, Abram gets a new name. He becomes Abraham. God takes Jacob off into Mesopotamia somewhere to learn things he has to learn and cannot learn at his mother's side. When he rides back into town, he has a limp and a new name as well. Even if your father did his job, he can only take you part way. There comes a time when you have to leave all that is familiar and go into the unknown with God. Saul was a guy who really thought he understood the story and very much liked the part he had written for himself. He was the hero of his own little mini-series, Saul the Avenger. After that little matter on the Damascus Road, he becomes Paul. And rather than heading back into all the old and familiar ways, he is led out into Arabia for 3 years to learn directly from God. Jesus shows that initiation can happen even when we've lost our father or grandfather. He's the carpenter's son, which means Joseph was able to help him in the early days of his journey. But when we meet the young man, Jesus, Joseph is out of the picture. Jesus has a new teacher, his true father, and it is from him he must learn who he really is and what he's really made of. Initiation involves a journey and a series of tests through which we discover our real name and our true place in the story. Robert Rourke's book, The Old Man and the Boy, is a classic example of this kind of relationship. There's a boy who needs a lot of teaching, and there's an old man who's got a lot of wisdom. But the initiation doesn't take place at a school desk. It takes place in the field, where simple lessons about the land and animals and seasons turn into larger lessons about life and self and God. Through each test comes a revelation. The boy must keep his eyes open and ask the right questions. Learning to hunt quail helps you learn about yourself. He's smart as a whip, and every time you go up against him, you're proving something about yourself. Most of us have been misinterpreting life and what God is doing for a long time. "I think I'm just trying to get God to make my life work easier," a client of mine confessed. But he could have been speaking for most of us. We're asking the wrong questions. Most of us are asking, "God, why did you let this happen to me?" Or, "God, why don't you just fill in the blank, help me succeed, get my kids straightened out, fix my marriage?" You know what you've been whining about. But to enter into a journey of initiation with God requires a new set of questions. What are you trying to teach me here? What issues in my heart are you trying to raise through this? What is it you want me to see? What are you asking me to let go of? In truth, God has been trying to initiate you for a long time. What is in the way is how you've mishandled your wound and the life you've constructed as a result. Men are taught over and over when they are boys that a wound that hurts is shameful, notes Bly. A wound that stops you from continuing to play is a girlish wound. He who is truly a man keeps walking, dragging his guts behind. Like a man who's broken his leg in a marathon, he finishes the race even if he has to crawl, and he doesn't say a word about it. That sort of misunderstanding is why, for most of us, our wound is an immense source of shame. A man's not supposed to get hurt. He's certainly not supposed to let it really matter. We've seen too many movies where the good guy takes an arrow, just breaks it off, and keeps on fighting. Or maybe he gets shot, but is still able to leap across a canyon and get the bad guys. And so most men minimize their wound. "It's not a big deal. Lots of people get hurt when they're young. I'm okay." King David, a guy who's hardly a pushover, doesn't act like that at all. "I am poor and needy," he confesses openly. and my heart is wounded within me. Psalm 109:22. Or perhaps they'll admit it happened, but deny it was a wound because they deserved it. After many months of counseling together about his wound, his vow, and how it was impossible to get the answer from women, I asked David a simple question. What would it take to convince you that you are a man? Nothing, he said. Nothing can convince me. We sat in silence as tears ran down my cheeks. You've embraced the wound, haven't you, Dave? You've owned its message as final. You think your father was right about you. Yes, he said, without any sign of emotion at all. I went home and wept. For Dave, for so many other men I know, and for myself, because I realized that I, too, had embraced my wound, and ever since, just tried to get on with life. Suck it up, as the saying goes. The only thing more tragic than the tragedy that happens to us is the way we handle it. God is fiercely committed to you, to the restoration and release of your masculine heart. But a wound that goes unacknowledged and unwept is a wound that cannot heal. A wound you've embraced is a wound that cannot heal. A wound you think you deserved is a wound that you cannot heal. That is why Brennan Manning says, "The spiritual life begins with the acceptance of our wounded self." Really? How can that be? The reason is simple. Whatever is denied cannot be healed. But that's the problem, you see. Most men deny their wound, deny that it happened, deny that it hurt, certainly deny that it's shaping the way they live today. And so, God's initiation of a man must take a very cunning course, a course that feels very odd, even cruel. He will wound us in the very place where we have been wounded. From the place of our woundedness, we construct a false self. We find a few gifts that work for us, and we try to live off them. Stuart found he was good at math and science. He shut down his heart and spent all his energies perfecting his Spock persona. There, in the academy, he was safe. He was also recognized and rewarded. Alex was good at sports and the whole macho image. He became a glass-eating animal. Stan became the nicest guy you could ever meet. In the story of my life, he admitted, I want to be seen as the nice guy. I became a hard-charging perfectionist. There, in my perfection, I found safety and recognition. When I was 8, confesses Brennan Manning, the imposter or false self was born as a defense against pain. The imposter within whispered, Brennan, don't ever be your real self anymore because nobody likes you as you are. Invent a new self that everybody will admire and nobody will know. Notice the key phrase, as a defense against pain, as a way of saving himself. The imposter is our plan for salvation. So God must take it all away. This often happens at the start of our initiation journey. He thwarts our plan for salvation. He shatters the false self. In the last chapter, I told you of Brad's plan for self-redemption. He would belong to the inside group. Even after it failed him time and again, breaking his heart over and over, he wouldn't give it up. He simply thought his aim was off. If he found the right group, then his plan would work. Our plan for redemption is hard to let go of. It clings to our hearts like an octopus. So what did God do for Brad? He took it all away. God brought Brad to the point where he thought he had found the group, and then God prevented him from maneuvering his way in. Brad wrote me a letter to describe what he was going through. God has taken all that away, stripped me of all the things I used to earn people's admiration. I knew what he was up to. He put me in a place where my heart's deepest wounds and arrows and sin came out. As I was weeping, all these pictures of what I want to belong to came up, speaker, counselor, in a group. And it was as if Jesus asked me to give them up. What came from my heart was surprising, incredible fear. And then the image of never getting them. A sentence arose in my heart. You want me to die. If I give up those, I'll never belong and be somebody. You are asking me to die. It has been my hope of salvation. Why would God do something so cruel? Why would he do something so terrible as to wound us in the place of our deepest wound? Jesus warned us that whoever wants to save his life will lose it. Christ is not using the word bios here. He's not talking about our physical life. The passage is not about trying to save your skin by ducking martyrdom or something like that. The word Christ uses for life is the word psyche, the word for our soul, our inner self, our heart. He says that the things we do to save our psyche, our self, those plans to save and protect our inner life, those are the things that will actually destroy us. There is a way that seems right to a man, but in the end it leads to death, says Proverbs 16:25. The false self, our plan for redemption, seems so right to us. It shields us from pain and secures us a little love and admiration. But the false self is a lie. The whole plan is built on pretense. It's a deadly trap. God loves us too much to leave us there. So he thwarts us in many, many different ways. In order to take a man into his wound, so that he can heal it and begin the release of the true self, God will thwart the false self. He will take away all you've leaned upon to bring you life. In the movie The Natural, Robert Redford is a baseball player named Roy Hobbs, perhaps the most gifted baseball player ever. He's a high school wonder boy, a natural who gets a shot at the big leagues. But his dreams of a professional career are cut short when Hobbs is wrongly sentenced to prison for murder. Years later, an aging Hobbs gets a second chance. He's signed by the New York Knights, the worst team in the league. But through his incredible gift, untarnished by the years, Hobbs leads the Knights from ignominy to the playoff game for the National League pennant. He rallies the team, becomes the center of their hopes and dreams. The climax of the film is the game for the championship. It's the bottom of the ninth. The score is Pittsburgh 2, Knights 0. The Knights have two outs. There's a man on first and third when Hobbs steps up to the plate. He's their only chance. This is his moment. Now, there's something you must know, something absolutely crucial to the story. Ever since his high school days, Hobbs has played with a bat he made himself from the heart of a tree felled by lightning in his front yard. Burned into the bat is a lightning bolt and the words, Wonder Boy. The bat is the symbol of his greatness, his giftedness. He has never, ever played with another. Clutching Wonder Boy, Hobbs steps up to the plate. His first swing is a miss. His second is a foul ball high and behind. His third is a solid hit along the first base line. It looks like a home run, but it also lands foul. As Hobbs returns to the plate, he sees his bat lying there, in pieces. It shattered on that last swing. This is the critical moment in a man's life, when all he has counted on comes crashing down, when his golden bat breaks into pieces. His investments fail, his company lets him go, the church fires him, he is leveled by an illness, his wife walks out, his daughter turns up pregnant. What is he to do? Will he stay in the game? Will he shrink back to the dugout? Will he scramble to try to put things back together as so many men do? The true test of a man, the beginning of his redemption, actually starts when he can no longer rely on what he's used all his life. The real journey begins when the false self fails. A moment that seems like an eternity passes as Hobbs stands there, holding the broken pieces, surveying the damage. The bat is beyond repair. Then he says to the bat boy, "Go pick me out a winner, Bobby." He stays in the game and hits a home run to win the series. God will take away our bat as well. He will do something to thwart the false self. Stewart saved himself by becoming emotionless. Last year, his wife walked out on him. She's had it with his two-dimensional existence. What woman wants to be married to Spock? Alex recently suffered a series of panic attacks that left him almost unable to leave his home. The whole macho construct fell to the ground. At first, nobody could believe it. Alex couldn't believe it. He was invincible, the strongest guy you ever met. But it was all built as a defense against the wound. Our loss doesn't necessarily have to be something so dramatic. A man may simply awaken one day to find himself lost, lost as Dante described himself. In the middle of the road of my life, I awoke in a dark wood where the true way was wholly lost. This was the turning point in my life. I went to Washington, D.C. as a young man to try to make something of myself, to prove something, establish credibility. The damnable thing about it was, I succeeded. My giftedness worked against me by coming through for me. I was recognized and rewarded. But the whole experience felt like an act of survival. Not something flowing out of a deep center, but something I had to prove, overcome, grasp. As Manning said of his own imposter, I studied hard, scored excellent grades, won a scholarship in high school, and was stalked every waking morning by the terror of abandonment and the sense that nobody was there for me. At the end of 2 years, I woke one morning and realized I hated my life. George MacDonald says in Diary of an Old Soul, "How many helps thou givest to those who would learn? To some sore pain, to others a sinking heart, to some a weariness worse than any smart, to some a haunting, fearing, blind concern, madness to some the shaking dart, of hideous death still following as they turn, to some a hunger that will not depart, to some thou givest a deep unrest, a scorn of all they are or see upon the earth, a gaze at dusky night and clearing morn, as on a land of emptiness and dearth, to some a bitter sorrow, to some the sting of love misprized, of sick abandoning, to some a frozen heart, oh, worse than anything. The messengers of Satan think to mar, but make, driving the soul from false to feel, to thee the reconciler, the one real, in whom alone the would-be and the is are met." This is a very dangerous moment when God seems set against everything that has meant life to us. Satan spies this opportunity and leaps to accuse God in our hearts. "You see," he says, "God is angry with you. He's disappointed in you. If he loved you, he would make things smoother. He's not out for your best, you know." The enemy always tempts us back toward control to recover and rebuild the false self. We must remember that it is out of love that God thwarts our imposter. As Hebrews reminds us, it is the Son whom God disciplines. Therefore, do not lose heart. God thwarts us to save us. We think it will destroy us, but the opposite is true. We must be saved from what really will destroy us. If we would walk with him in our journey of masculine initiation, we must walk away from the false self, set it down, give it up willingly. It feels crazy. It feels immensely vulnerable. Brad has stopped looking for the group. Stuart has begun to open up his heart to emotion, to relationship, to all that he buried so long ago. Alex stopped eating glass, stopped the whole macho thing to face what he has never faced inside. I gave up perfectionism, left Washington, and went looking for my heart. We simply accept the invitation to leave all that we've relied on and venture out with God. We can choose to do it ourselves, or we can wait for God to bring it all down. If you have no clue as to what your false self may be, then a starting point would be to ask those you live with and work with, "What is my effect on you? What am I like to live with or work with? What don't you feel free to bring up with me?" If you never, ever say a word in a meeting because you fear you might say something stupid, well, then it's time to speak up. If all you ever do is dominate a meeting because your sense of worth comes from being in charge, then you need to shut up for a while. If you've run to sports because you feel best about yourself there, then it's probably time to give it a rest and stay home with your family. If you never play any game with other men, and it's time you go down to the gym with the guys and play some hoops. In other words, you face your fears head on. Drop the fig leaf. Come out of hiding. For how long? Longer than you want to. Long enough to raise the deeper issues. Let the wound surface from beneath it all. Losing the false self is painful. Though it's a mask, it's one we've worn for years, and losing it can feel like losing a close friend. Underneath the mask is all the hurt and fear we've been running from, hiding from. To let it come to the surface can shake us like an earthquake. Brad felt as if he was going to die. You may too. Or you may feel like Andy Gullihorn, who wrote the song Steel Bars from Old Hat. This is how it feels at the rock bottom of despair, when the house I build comes crashing down. And this is how it feels when I know the man that I say I am is not the man that I am when no one's around. But this is not the end of the road. It's the trailhead. What you are journeying towards is freedom, healing, and authenticity. Listen to the next part of Andy's song. This is how it feels to come alive again and start fighting back to gain control. And this is how it feels to let freedom in and break the chains that enslave my soul. As we walk away from the self, we will feel vulnerable and exposed. We will be sorely tempted to turn to our comforters for some relief, those places that we found solace and rest. Because so many of us turn to the woman for our sense of masculinity, we must walk away from her as well. I do not mean leave your wife. I mean you stop looking to her to validate you. Stop trying to make her come through for you. Stop trying to get your answer from her. For some men, this may mean disappointing her. If you've been a passive man, tiptoeing around your wife for years, never doing anything to rock the boat, then it's time to rock it. Stand up to her. Get her mad at you. For those of you violent men, including achievers, it means stop abusing her. You release her as the object of your anger because you release her as the one who was supposed to make you a man. Repentance for a driven man means you become kind. Both types are still going to the woman. Repentance depends on which way you've approached her. But I have counseled many young men to break up with the woman they were dating because they had made her their life. She was the sun of his universe, around which he orbited. A man needs a much bigger orbit than a woman. He needs a mission, a life purpose, and he needs to know his name. Only then is he fit for a woman, for only then does he have something to invite her into. A friend tells me that in the Maasai tribe in Africa, a young man cannot court a woman until he has killed a lion. That's their way of saying until he has been initiated. I have seen far too many young men commit a kind of emotional promiscuity with a young woman. He will pursue her, not to offer his strength, but to drink from her beauty, to be affirmed by her, and to feel like a man. They will share deep, intimate conversations, but he will not commit. He is unable to commit. This is very unfair to the young lady. After a year of this sort of relationship, a dear friend said, "I never felt secure in what I meant to him." When we feel the pull toward the golden-haired woman, we must recognize that something deeper is at play. As Bly says, "What does it mean when a man falls in love with a radiant face across the room? It may mean that he has some soul work to do. His soul is the issue. Instead of pursuing the woman and trying to get her alone, he needs to go alone himself, perhaps to a mountain cabin, for 3 months, write poetry, canoe down a river, and dream. That would save some women a lot of trouble." Again, this is not permission to divorce. A man who has married a woman has made her a solemn pledge. He can never heal his wound by delivering another to the one he promised to love. Sometimes she will leave him. That is another story. Too many men run after her, begging her not to go. If she has to go, it is probably because you have some soul work to do. What I am saying is that the masculine journey always takes a man away from the woman in order that he may come back to her with his question answered. A man does not go to a woman to get his strength. He goes to her to offer it. You do not need the woman for you to become a great man. And as a great man, you do not need the woman. As Augustine said, "Let my soul praise you for all these beauties, but let it not attach itself to them by the trap of love." The trap of addiction because we've taken our soul to her for validation. But there is an even deeper issue than our question. What else is it we are seeking from the woman with the golden hair? What is that ache we are trying to assuage with her? Mercy, comfort, beauty, ecstasy. In a word, God. I'm serious. What we are looking for is God. There was a time when Adam drank deeply from the source of all love. He, our first father and archetype, lived in an unbroken communion with the most captivating, beautiful, and intoxicating source of life in the universe. Adam had God. True, it was not good for man to be alone, and God in his humility gave us Eve, allowed us to need her as well. But something happened at the fall. Something shifted. Eve took the place of God in a man's life. Let me explain. Adam was not deceived by the serpent. Did you know that? Paul makes it clear in 1 Timothy 2:14. Adam did not fall because he was deceived. His sin was different. In some ways, it was more serious in that he did it with open eyes. We do not know how long it lasted, but there was a moment in Eden when Eve was fallen and Adam was not. She had eaten, but he yet had a choice. I believe something took place in his heart that went like this. "I have lost my Ezer Konegdo, my soulmate, the most vital companion I've known. I do not know what life will be like, but I know I cannot live without her." Adam chose Eve over God. If you think I exaggerate, simply look around. Look at all the art, poetry, music, drama devoted to the beautiful woman. Listen to the language men use to describe her. Watch the powerful obsession at work. What else can this be but worship? Men come into the world without the God who was our deepest joy, our ecstasy. Aching for we know not what, we meet Eve's daughters, and we are history. She is the closest thing we've ever encountered, the pinnacle of creation, the very embodiment of God's beauty and mystery and tenderness and allure. And what goes out to her is not just our longing for Eve, but our longing for God as well. A man without his true love, his life, his God, will find another. What better substitute than Eve's daughters? Nothing else in creation even comes close. To a young man who had never been without a girlfriend since the 8th grade, I gave the advice that he should break up, call off all dating for 1 year. From the look on his face, you'd have thought I told him to cut off his arm, or something worse. Do you see what is at work here? Notice that the struggle with pornography or masturbation is most difficult when you are lonely or beat up or longing for comfort in some way. This will become more intense as you get closer to your wound. The longing for the ache to go away and the pull toward other comforters can seem overwhelming. I've watched it in many men and know it in myself. But if this is the water you are truly thirsty for, then why do you remain thirsty after you've had a drink? It's the wrong well. We must reverse Adam's choice. We must choose God over Eve. We must take our ache to Him. For only in God will we find the healing of our wound.